This is the story of George Abbott, miracle worker, the showman who's been responsible for more Broadway successes than any other man. 38, to be exact. In 1941, just after Abbott chalked up his sixth consecutive hit musical, a columnist wrote of him, "I think George has managed to repeal the law of averages." Now, if you were to meet George Abbott, you'd never dream that he was in show business. The writer Brendan Gill says of him, "He's a teetotaler and looks it." A tall, lean, rather forbidding man, Abbott is also a non-smoker, a non-swearer, and almost a non-smiler. You'd take his age to be about 60, but he is, in fact, in his late 80s. So let's ring up the curtain with a medley of songs from some of those 38 hits of his.
Just knock three times and whisper low that you and I were sent by Joe. Then strike a match and you will know you're in. Turn and go, side away. Oy.
I love a quiet girl. I love a gentle girl, warm as sunlight, soft, soft as snow. Her smile, a tender smile, her voice, a velvet voice, sweet as music, soft, soft as snow.
But I'm not at all in love, not at all in love, not I, not a straw, not a hair. I don't care if he's as strong as a lion, sighing. You may be sold, but this girl is mine. I'm not at all in love.
Falling in love with love is falling for me.
That last song, one of Richard Rodgers' loveliest waltzes, comes from the very first musical presented by George Abbott, The Boys from Syracuse. He also directed the show and wrote the libretto. He could have acted in it too if he'd wanted. Abbott started as an actor, and a good one too, apparently. He first played on Broadway in 1913 and was soon in demand, particularly for rugged outdoor roles. For 12 years, he acted in plays with such long-forgotten titles as Processional, A Holy Terror, White Desert, and Xander the Great. Then, at the age of 37, he scored a massive hit as the co-author and director of the play Broadway. For 9 years, he directed plays, mostly farces. In 1935 and 6, he directed his first two musicals, Jumbo and The Boys from Syracuse, a musical version of The Comedy of Errors. The show's composer, Richard Rodgers, tells how that one came about.
That evolved out of the fact that Jimmy Savile, who was a very well-known comedian, looked exactly like Larry Hart's kid brother, who was a less well-known comedian. And we thought it might be fun to do a show with Teddy Hart and Jimmy Savile playing the Dromios. And we talked to George Abbott about it, and he thought that was fine. And that was how that show got on. But there was just one line of Shakespeare in the entire show. The The rest was a perfectly good Faust book.
The book, in other words, the script, wasn't supposed to have been written by George Abbott at all. Rodgers and Hart intended doing it with him, but Abbott wrote the first draft, and the songwriters were so satisfied with it that they left the job to him and concentrated on the songs. And what songs?
Boys!
When The Boys from Syracuse opened on Broadway, the critic of the New York Herald Tribune wrote, "If you have been wondering all these years what was wrong with the Comedy of Errors, it is now possible to tell you. It has been waiting for a score by Rodgers and Hart and direction by George Abbott." Incidentally, that one line of Shakespeare's that Richard Rodgers referred to in The Boys from Syracuse was actually two lines. "The venom clamors of a jealous woman poisons more deadly than a mad dog's tooth." Well, I just thought you'd like to know.
Sing for your supper and you'll get breakfast. Songbirds always eat if their song is sweet to hear. Sing for your luncheon and you'll get dinner. Dine with wine of choice if romance is in your voice. I heard from a wise canary, trilling makes a and you'll get breakfast. Songbirds always eat if their song is sweet to hear. Sing for your luncheon and you'll get dinner. Dine with wine of choice if romance is in your voice. I heard from a wise canary, trilling makes you willing. So sing for your supper and you'll get breakfast. Songbirds are not dumb. They don't buy a crumb of bread. It's said, so sing and you'll be fed. Sing for your supper and you'll get breakfast. Songbirds always eat if the song is sweet to if romance is in your voice. I heard from a white canary, trilling makes a fellow willing. So little swallow, swallow now. Now is the time to sing for your supper. You'll get breakfast. Songbirds are not dumb. They don't have to buy a crumb of bread, a spool of thread. Just sing instead. You don't have to buy even a crumb of bread, it said. You'll be fed if you sing.
After Boys from Syracuse, Abbott considered another Shakespearean musical, This time with Much Ado About Nothing as the basis, but he soon went off the idea, and instead he produced and directed a show with a college setting called Too Many Girls. Like Syracuse, this was one of Abbott's non-star musicals. Although he's done a lot of shows which were vehicles for well-known performers, he prefers team productions, cast with relative unknowns. Not only is it less expensive, but it makes for a quieter life. As Abbott once wrote, "I like to concentrate on a play, not a star. A play can't ask you back to its dressing room and complain about its troubles." In Too Many Girls, the non-stars were newcomers Desi Arnaz, Eddie Bracken, and a chorus boy named Van Johnson. The songwriters were again Rodgers and Hart.
"I didn't know what time it was, then I met you. Oh, what a lovely time it was, how sublime it was too. I didn't know what day it was, you held my hand. Warm like the month of May it was, and I'll say it was grand, grand to be alive, to be young, to be mad, to be yours alone. Grand to see your face, feel your touch, hear your voice, say I'm all your own. Didn't know what year it was, life was no prize. I wanted love and here it was, shining out of your eyes. I'm wise and I know what time it is now."
What was George Abbott's position in the theatre? We asked one of his many discoveries, the very successful producer-director, Harold Prince.
Abbott was the most important producer, impresario, in the American theatre. I mean, he started perhaps in the 20s as a star. He's 88 now, and still writing and directing very well indeed. He's very vigorous. And then he went from that into directing and writing melodramas. Then he wrote and directed comedies, co-authored. So indeed, he did all those early farces. Three Men on a Horse, Room Service, 20th Century. He almost gave the identity to the American farce. Then he went from that into the musicals with Rodgers and Hart. All the early musicals, including Pal Joey, which was not an early musical, but a watershed musical.
I'm wild again. Beguiled again, a simpering, whimpering child again. Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I. Couldn't sleep and wouldn't sleep until I could sleep where I shouldn't sleep. Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered.
Pal Joey meant a lot of work for Abbott. In fact, far more than he'd bargained for, according to Stanley Green.
He produced it, directed it, and I believe he did quite a lot of the writing also, even though the only name that's on the credit is that of John O'Hara.
O'Hara was fond of drinking and often hard to locate when script changes were needed. As Rogers remembers, so was Hart.
He was entirely not depending. You could figure on it. Larry said he'd be there at 3:00. he was certainly there by six. But he never got angry at Larry because he was a sweet man. He was a really nice guy.
A nice guy or not, the situation must have been intolerable for a teetotaler like Abbott, but he finally got the show into shape and onto Broadway. Pal Joey was ready for New York, but was New York ready for it? Many critics were shocked down to their shoes. Brooks Atkinson of the New York Times wrote, "Although it is expertly done, can you draw sweet water from a foul well?" Despite notices like this, or perhaps because of them, Pal Joey had a longer run than either Jumbo or On Your Toes or Too Many Girls. But a run of 374 performances was still disappointing for a show which was clearly Rodgers and Hart's best. Another of their witty numbers mocked the intellectual pretensions of Gypsy Rose Lee, also bringing in the names of most of her rivals in the stripping game.
I've interviewed Leslie Howard. I've interviewed Noel Coward. I've interviewed the great Stravinsky. But my greatest achievement is the interview I had with the star who worked for Minsky. I met her at the Yankee Clipper, and she didn't unzip one zipper. I said, "Miss Lee, you are such an artist. Tell me why you never miss. What do you think of while you work?" And she said, "While I work, my thoughts go something like this. Zip. Walter Lippmann wasn't brilliant today. Zip. Will Saroya never write a great play? Zip. I was reading Schopenhauer last night. Zip. And I think that Schopenhauer was right. I don't want to see Serena. I don't want to meet Cabina. Zip. I'm an intellectual. I don't like a deep contralto or a man whose voice is alto. Zip. I'm a heterosexual. Zip. My intelligence is guiding my hand. Zip. Who the hell is Sally Brand?
George Abbott's next production was inspired by stern practicality. It was the summer of 1941. America was not yet in the war, but men were being conscripted all the same. With this in mind, Abbott decided to do a show using actors who were far below conscription age and so keep his cast intact. The show was called Best Foot Forward, and to do the choreography, Abbott hired the man who'd just been playing Pal Joey for him, Gene Kelly. Now, it was in 1944 that another choreographer, Jerome Robbins, staged Leonard Bernstein's first ballet, Fancy Free, which dealt with the adventures of three sailors on shore leave in Manhattan. Now, musicals have been based on plays, novels, short stories, fairy tales, and even comic strips, but there can't be more than one that was ever based on a ballet. Originally scheduled for only seven performances, it was a sensation, and the writers, Betty Comden and Adolph Green, talked Bernstein and Robbins into enlarging it to make a full-scale Broadway musical comedy. As none of the four had done a musical before, they chose George Abbott to direct. Abbott has been nicknamed the Apprentice's Sorcerer, and rightly so. The expanded Fancy Free turned out to be an even bigger sensation.
New York, New York!
In it, beneath the Broadway light.
But we hair on our chest, so what we like the rest of the nights.
Sight, sight, sight!
New York, New York, a hell of a town. The Bronx is up and the battery's down. The people ride in a hole in the ground. New York, New York, it's a hell of a town.
Gaby, here, there are 20,000 streets in New York City, not counting MacDougal Alley in the heart of Greenwich Village, a charming thoroughfare.
Here we go again.
The famous places to visit are so many, or so the guidebooks say. I promised Daddy I wouldn't miss on any, and we have just one day. Gotta see the whole town from Yonkers on down to the bay.
In just one day, New York, New York, a visitor's place, where no one lives on account of the pace, but 7 million are screaming for space. New York, New York, it's a visitor's place.
Hey, look who's coming back, Tom and Andy.
Hey, Tom, Andy. Hey, fellas, how was your day in New York?
Oh, wonderful. I don't remember a thing.
Awful. I remember everything. Manhattan women are dressed in silk and satin, what's all the fellas say? There's just one thing that's important in Manhattan. When you have just one day, gotta pick up a date.
Maybe 7 or 8
on your way in just one day.
New York,
hell of a town, hell of a town.
The Bronx is up and the battery's down.
The people ride in a hole in the ground.
New York, it's a hell of a town.
Abbott's next hit had more memorable dances by Jerome Robbins, including a riotously funny Keystone Cops ballet. The star was a pre-Bilko, Phil Silvers, the composer Julie Stein, and the lyric writer Sammy Kahn.
I think if you have George Abbott alone, you have a more than even chance of making it through the Broadway jungle.
The show that Abbott brought so successfully through the jungle was called High Button Shoes.
Look, Papa, there's Daddy the Polka. Come on and dance.
Oh, I got 2 left feet, Mama, you know that.
Now, you know you're a good dancer, Papa, come on.
Well, I haven't danced since our wedding, Sarah.
Not even a polka.
Not me.
Papa, won't you dance with me? Oh, dance with me, please dance with me. Papa, take a chance with me and dance with me tonight. And when you whirl me around and around, we'll go right off the ground. We'll go around and around, we'll go. And when we hear those trombones sliding high, we'll both be gliding high up to the sky. I love the polka, Papa, won't you dance with me? Dance with me, please dance with me. When you hold me tight, oh, Papa, won't you dance with me? With me, please dance with me. Papa, take a chance with me and dance with me tonight.
You know that when I try to turn about, my feet are both in doubt. I'd rather sit this out. It's not that I don't like to dance a bit. That's just the heck of it. I love the way they dance the polka.
Papa, won't you dance? Dance with me, please dance with me. When you hold me tight. Oh, Papa, won't you dance with me?
Won't you dance with me tonight?
In 1945, Abbott went to a Hollywood party and heard Frank Lesser and his wife sing Lesser's song, Baby, It's Cold Outside. Afterwards, Abbott told Lesser that he'd love to do a Broadway show with him, and 2 years later they worked together on Where's Charlie, a musical version of Charlie's Aunt. Abbott directed and did the adaptation. As the star Ray Bolger remembers, the project was fraught with problems.
We all sat down together and said, well, how are we going to do Charlie's Aunt as a musical comedy? It's been done once in Germany and was a disaster, and it was all very effeminate. It was not the sort of thing that we wanted to do. The reason being difficult to do Charlie's Aunt as a musical comedy is that the first act was all exposition. And the exposition of, well, who was Lord Fancourt Beverley, and who was who, and who edited who was doing what, and that whole mess that would take up most of the time in a musical comedy. So it was impossible to put it on. So I suddenly came up with the idea, well, why doesn't Charlie play his own aunt? They thought that was a great idea, but how are we to get that situation? How are we going to make it work? How is it going to, so that the audience will accept it? Well, I said, we're playing a farce. If you believe in what you're doing, maybe it will come off. Let's try. And we did this whole thing, and we got away with it. And we finally got together a really wonderful score. Frank Lesser was the New Ashmolean Marching Society and Students Conservatory band, and that was very successful.
Here they come with the clarinets a-wailing. Here they come rather bravely up the square. And I know in a moment I'll be cheering. And my fine Sunday hat will be high in the air for the new
George Abbott began one of the most fruitful periods of his career, his association with Harold Prince. Abbott has a great admiration for Prince.
He's a smart fellow. He was a smart boy. He worked in my office, not for me, but for some little organization that was there. And when it broke up, I remember this one smart kid, and so I gave him a job as an assistant stage manager. And he worked for me until he and Bobby Griffith, who was the stage manager, became producers, and then I worked for them. I quit producing, which I didn't like anyhow, and we did a lot of shows together.
The first of these shows was based on a novel called 7½ Cents. Abbott agreed to direct the show if Griffith and Prince got a suitable writer to adapt the novel. Well, every suitable writer turned the job down flat. It sounds fantastic today, but in 1954, with Senator McCarthy looking for communists under every bed in America, the subject matter of 7½ Cents, a strike in a garment factory, looked frighteningly controversial. Finally, Abbott decided to do the adaptation himself, in collaboration with the author of the novel. Oh, yes, and he also thought of a catchier title than 7½ Cents.
The pajama game is the game I'm in, and I'm proud to be in the pajama game. I love it. I can hardly wait to wake and get to work at 8. Nothing's quite the same as the pajama game. I'm an executive. I'm a time study man. I can tell you for seconds how many stitches go into a pair of pajamas. I can time anything. You'll see when we get down to the factory. Let it go.
Racing with the clock.
Hurry up, girl. Seconds are ticking.
Shortly after the pajama game opened, Abbott was simultaneously rehearsing a revival of On Your Toes, working with William Saroyan on a musical about a sailor looking for his lost love in the streets of San Francisco, casting and rehearsing the tour of Pajama Game, and working on a new musical with Hal Prince.
Merely a few days after Pajama Game opened, this book, which was called The Year the Yankees Lost the Pennant, Abbott found it. Somebody brought it to him. We agreed to do it, all of us. Same group of people went back to work, Bobby Fosse, Adler and Ross, they were the composers. We got Gwen Verdon, and we did it. Turned out to be almost as big a hit as Pajama Game.
Oh, yes, and they also thought of a catchier title than the day the Yankees lost the pennant. Damn Yankees.
Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. And little man, little Lola wants you. Make up your mind to have no regrets. Recline yourself, resign yourself, you're through. I always get what I aim for, and your heart and soul is what I care. Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. No use to fight, don't you know you can't win? You're no exception to the rule. I'm irresistible, you fool. Give in. Give in. Give in.
Hello, Joe. It's me. He hit so far. Hold on. That's you. Boop, boop, boop. Heart and soul is what I care. you'll never win. I'm irresistible, you fool. Give in. Give in.
Bob Fosse received love letters from the critics for his Damn Yankees choreography. Now, how does Fosse feel about Abbott?
Well, George is sort of an enigma. He is the supreme authority when you're working with him. He's very stoic. Seems very difficult to penetrate any sort of emotion from him at all, to gain any sort of emotion. But I have loved my working relationship with him the first two times. The third time it was not a happy relationship. It's when we took the parting of the ways, but I liked him a lot. I learned a great deal from him.
Bob Fosse was not the only one to learn from George Abbott. People have been learning from him for over 50 years, and not only in the world of the musical, but in the straight theater as well, where his output has been equally prolific and distinguished. So prolific, indeed, that, unhappily, time prevents us from more than sketching the highlights. It was Abbott's protege, Hal Prince, and Bobby Griffith, who asked him to direct and collaborate on the book of a musical about New York's colorful mayor, Fiorello LaGuardia. The show had a score by two newcomers who would later write the classic Fiddler on the Roof, composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick.
Abbott had a wonderful way of getting the best work out of everybody. I remember bringing him a lyric I was very fond of, and he listened to it, and he smiled, and he said, "That's wonderful. That's just wonderful." And George is, I think, 8'3". He came over, and he put his big arm around my shoulder, and he said, "But would Larry Hart have been satisfied with that?" And I looked at him, I said, "Well, I guess not. I guess it could be better." And went off and did a better lyric.
A little tin box, a little tin box, and a little tin key unlocks. There is nothing unorthodox about a little tin box.
About a little tin box.
About a little tin box.
In a little tin box, a little tin box, and a little tin key unlocks.
There is honor and purity,
lots of security, in a little tin box.
Next witness, take the stand.
You're a junior official, and your income's rather low. Yet you've kept a dozen women in the very best hotels. Would you kindly explain how so?
I can see your honor doesn't pull his punches, and it looks a trifle fishy, I'll admit. But for one whole week I went without my lunches, and it mounted up your honor bit by bit.
Up your honor, bit by bit.
It's just a
little tin box. A little tin box. And a little tin key unlocks. There is nothing unorthodox about a little tin box.
About a little tin box.
About a little tin box.
In a little tin box. A little tin box.
There is something delectable,
almost respectable, in a little tin box, in a little tin box.
A show about which Abbott's feelings must be mixed is Flora the Red Menace. The year was 1965. Senator McCarthy had long since gone to that great anti-commie rally in the sky, and it was safe to do a light-hearted musical about a young girl in the 1930s joining the Communist Party. Hal Prince produced, and Abbott collaborated on the script and directed. The songs were by John Kander and Fred Ebb, later to write Cabaret, and the star was Liza Minnelli. But Abbott, who'd seen her in a revival of Best Foot Forward, originally felt that she was wrong for the part. In fact, when she first auditioned for it, he said loudly to an assistant, "Well, this is going to be a waste of time."
As I was walking out there, my knees, which had previously gone, were now going. But then Hal called me in the last act. Already gotten another Broadway show, you know. I really just wanted to do your show. You know, I really wanted to do Flora. And they called me on the Thursday, and they had to have the part cast by Friday. And he worked with me a little bit, and I came back, and I got it with Abbott out of town and everything.
Both John Kander and his partner Fred Ebb wanted Liza for the part, but Abbott was like a rock.
I remember that.
because he was sort of adamant till the end, no, she wouldn't be right. And then we'd seen everybody, and finally we prevailed upon Hal. Then we got Hal to call Abbott on the phone, and it was as easy as, well, look, George, we've looked around, and we can't come up with another Flora, and we really think it ought to be Liza. Well, all right, if you want her, that's fine, all right.
The thing is that later on, Abbott did a complete switch.
Oh.
He absolutely fell in love with her.
All I need is one good break, just one good break, then, Mr. Watch My Speed. One substantial break is all I need. One substantial break is all I need to make them all stand up and cheer. Set the world of art right on its ear. Give me a chance. I don't want any handouts. Give me a boost, 'cause I got it all planned out. Give me a lift, and I bet you they stand outside my door all begging for a chance to study my sketches. All I need is one good break, just one good break, then, mister, watch my speed.
All I need is one good break, just
one substantial break is all I need.
Substantial break is all I need.
One substantial break is all I need to make a splash that won't forget.
New York, I'm gonna get you.
Hey, New York, I'm gonna get you yet.
Give me a chance, and I know I can do it. Give me a boost, and I'm gonna see to it. Give me a lift.
Some new Italian clothes,
a private plane,
and see the latest shows.
And strike a fancy pose,
and Mom and Dad wouldn't know me.
All I need is one good break, just one.
All I need is one good break, just one.
All I need is one good break, just one.
All I need is one good break, just one good break, and Mr. Watch My Speed.
Flora the Red Menace only ran for 87 performances, but Liza Minnelli's performance won her the much-prized Tony Award. It was early in the 1960s that Abbott had two Broadway hits, the domestic comedy Never Too Late, which sounds like the story of his life, and the Stephen Sondheim musical A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. Later, well, we'll let Abbott tell us about it himself.
I directed A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum in London, and I had one of the men from that old comedy group, whatever it was called. And they adjusted to play it my way very readily.
It was the Crazy Gang, George, and it was Monsieur Eddie Gray. The rest of the fine British comedy cast numbered Frankie Howard, John Pertwee, Robertson Hare, and Kenneth Connor. Now, Connor has no trouble in remembering the experience. Long before Abbott arrived in Britain, he and the other experienced comics in the cast had had to audition.
Auditions are very funny things, horrifying things in many ways. There are people who become quite hung up on auditions, and when established artists and funny men like Eddie Gray and Robertson Hare and people like that are probably asked to go along for the benefit of some American director who, because of the thousands of miles, doesn't know them, it's only right that they should find out, A, if they could sing for a musical. I went along feeling a bit daft about it all, and what can you sing? And I knew the rehearsal pianist. I said, oh, maybe it's because I'm a Londoner. So I went, maybe it's because I'm a Londoner. And a voice up front said, I love that song. I just love that song. And they started talking to each other about the song. And the pianist said, I guess that's all right. And all the Cockney people were saying, oh, I guess it is. And I, do you guess it is? I guess it's time for tea. You know, it was on to us immediately. And then we went away and afterwards heard that the great Monsieur Eddie Gray had turned up, staggering in through the door, and these legs of his that he never quite seemed to master, you know. He said, we want you to sing for us. And he says, oh, anything for a party, like, you know, sort of thing. And he gets on the stage with his unseeing eyes, and he just goes down on the piano and goes, happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you, happy birthday. There's no bastard out there, he said.
She's a lovely blooming flower. He's just a sprout. Impossible.
She's a lovely blooming flower. He's all worn out. Impossible.
Just a fledgling in the nest.
Just a man who needs a rest.
He's a beamish boy at best.
Poor old fellow.
He's a child and loves a test. He's too young, too fast. Impossible.
He has asthma, gout, a wife, lumbago and gas. Irascible.
Romping in the nursery.
He looks tired.
Son, sit on your father's knee.
Father, you can lean on me.
Him. Impossible.
The much-missed Eddie Gray. Now, the cast were prepared for the coming of their director by the two writers of the show's book.
Yes, the first week, Bert Shevelove, Larry Gelbart, came over with Ruth, his real right-hand man, you might say. And they made sure that we all knew what punctuality meant. And Bert Shevelove was a great wit. Said, if I can remember correctly, he said something like, "Now you're going to be directed here by Mr. George Abbott, what is known as the doyen of Broadway." And he said, "Now, Mr. Abbott is not just one of your ordinary theater directors. Now, Cole Porter, Gershwin, and a few other people of that ilk have all been known to go into the red bankwise. But Mr. Abbott's, never. They put S on the end of everything, much to the annoyance of Mr. Gray and all the others who were in the cast. So I want you all to be here punctual. When I say rehearsal at 10, I want you here 1:45. And I want you all sitting around in these chairs, in this semicircle, waiting for him. He will not tolerate any slackness of any kind. Now, I don't want to be brutal, but that's the way it's going to be. He'll be arriving here in a week's time. In the meantime, we'll get the layout of the play as performed in the sticks. And believe me, folks, we know what we're doing. We don't want any stupid suggestions. So we used to be there every morning, 9:45, on the dot, sitting around in a semicircle, rather like the trial scene from St. Joan, waiting, waiting, waiting. They would turn up, we would rehearse. Every morning there, on the dot, and he turned up one morning. And they said, "Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. George Abbott." And on he came, and he said, "Welcome, welcome. I've been seeing this wonderful city of yours, and I'm hoping that I'll be just as happy here working all of us." What are they all sitting around like that for, Ruth?
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something appealing, something appalling, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Nothing with kings, nothing with crowns. Bring on the lovers, liars and clowns. Old situations, new complications. Nothing portentous or polite. Tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight.
On his first morning, Abbott addressed the cast in his usual no-nonsense manner. Kenneth Connor recreates that address.
Okay, so now I'd like to meet the people. And he said, "Mr. Howards, Mr. Pertwees, Mr. Grace, Mr. Connors, Mr. Harris. We know from you, Mr. Harris, because of way back all which fusses, we've no bother there. Now, I understand you're all by way of being funny men. Well, this is great. This is what we want, funny men." And he said, "And, of course, I hear by the grapevine you have all worked together amicably in the past. Now, this play is nothing. Absolutely nothing. If you try to delve into this play, you'll find nothing and you'll lose confidence in it. So I want you all to act it for everything it's worth. When the virgin is attacked by the old man, you got to be horrified. When the soldiers come on, I want you to cower back and really mean it. And I want you to rehearse it in such a way that all of you begin to think, after a fortnight's rehearsal, you're never going to get a laugh at all, because only by being sincere in this are you going to get the laughs." Well, of course, Eddie Gray is the greatest wit of the lot. He took his time, and he said, "May I address you, Mr. Abbott?" He said, "I'm right here, Mr. Gray," said this voice. He said, "I'm known," he said, "for bunging in the H's where they ain't, putting them in where they are." You see? So this voice says, "Come again? What did Mr. Gray say?"
She said he said something, Mr. Abbott, about he's known over here. You see, he leaves out the H's, like, you know, and then when there aren't any H's, Mr. Grace sort of puts them in. He said, well, why would he do a thing like that? He said, apparently, Mr. Abbott, it makes them laugh. He said, that's something I'd never thought of. So he said, would you tell me again, Mr. Grace, what do you want? He said, I would like to know, Mr. Abbott, he bugging in the S's as well, because he called us Grays and Pertwees and Connors, you know. He said, I would like to know, Mr. Abbott, if you meant in this part, if I ease up the H's where they are and bugs them in where they ain't. He said, well, now, look here, Mr. Graves. He said, if you think that is the way a Roman patrician nobleman would talk, I go right along with you. If, on the other hand, you should have a little bit of conscience about it, don't be frightened to admit that you'd like to leave the H's hot when they is in the H's.
Everybody ought to have a working girl. Everybody ought to have a lurking girl to putter around the house. Everybody ought to have a maid.
Everybody ought to have a maid.
Everybody ought to have a menial, consistently congenial, and quieter than a mouse. Oh, wouldn't she be delicious, tidying up the dishes, neat as a pin? Oh, wouldn't she be delightful, sweeping out, sleeping in?
Ooh.
Everybody ought to have a maid.
Everybody ought to have a maid.
Someone who will fetch you your slipper will be winsome as a whippoorwill and graceful as a goose. Skittering down the hallway, flittering through the parlour, gittering in the pantry, littering up the bedroom, puttering all around the house.
The overriding memory of it is the sincerity of the thing. He was a real director of the theatre. And when you meet someone who is a real director, it's so simple and happy then. But he reminded me to look at of Eisenhower.
It would be anticlimactic if not impertinent to try and sum up the many-faceted and brilliant career of Mr. Abbott, as he is properly and almost reverently known throughout the world of show business. It is, I feel, more fitting and proper that the last word should come from Mr. Abbott himself.
Certainly, those of us who work in the theater are the luckiest people in the world, because, in the first place, work is the most fun in the world, and the second place, to have work that's played and get paid for it is just ideal.
And that's George Abbott, Master American Showman.
Michael Grave was a presenter of The American Showman. Research was by Bill Sullivan, and the writer was Dick Vosborough. The producer was David Raven Allen. And now Benny Green will take a brief look at the career of Mike Todd, next week's American Showman. But before that, he adds a postscript to the career of George Abbott.
When that program was first recorded, the most amazing fact of all about George Abbott could not be disclosed because it still wasn't apparent. Certainly he was old, but he wasn't quite immortal. But now, some years later, the world might be pardoned for thinking that perhaps George Abbott is immortal. A few bald statistics. He was born in 1887. So that by the time he directed a revival of the Pajama Game in 1973, he was already into his mid-80s and at a stage in his life when most men are posthumous. In 1974, Abbott directed a revival of one of his old successes, Life with Father. In 1976, he did a show called Music Is, an adaptation of Twelfth Night. By this time, he was approaching his 90th birthday and so understandably was beginning to need a rest. So it wasn't until 1978 that he did his next show, called Winning is Everything. And then in 1982, he directed a revival of one of his earliest Rodgers and Hart successes, On Your Toes, scheduled for its arrival on Broadway in 1983. By which time, according to our arithmetic, Abbott's going on 96 and carrying the hopes of the entire profession that he'll turn out to be the man of the century. Now, as for the man who follows him in the showman's succession next week, Mike Todd, well, his fate was the opposite, because he was doomed to a premature death when he was in his prime. In a way, if we had to choose just one man who was the showman, maybe Mike Todd would be it. He was everything that that word showman evokes. He was brash, noisy, explosive, impudent, blatant, daring, colourful, and he was always willing to take a chance on a new idea. And that's why a lot of the things he backed and produced were not orthodox stage shows at all that the other showmen involved themselves in. Todd was always looking for new forms. He was, for instance, the man who did a jazzed-up version of Gilbert and Sullivan called the Hot Mikado. He ran a vast amusement centre called, would you believe, Gay New Orleans. He did shows featuring dance bands. He did shows featuring Abbott and Costello. He even did a stage version of the sexiest of all the empresses of Russia called, believe it or not, Catherine Was Great. And then he had the idea of casting Mae West in the role. She accepted too, which was a feather in Todd's cap. But there were also spectacular flops. Next week we'll hear about his bankruptcy, about the disaster shows, as well as the successes. And there was one moment in Todd's career, as there usually is in the lives of even the smartest theatre operators, when he backed his own judgment and cost himself maybe untold millions. You see, one day they offered him Oklahoma, and he rejected it because he said it had no jokes. Well, he was right about the jokes, but the audiences didn't seem to mind. A very revealing example of Todd's ruthless drive when he had a show he believed in comes from the comedian Milton Berle. Now, here's the scenario. Berle is starring in a smash hit called The Ziegfeld Follies, and Mike Todd, holding in his hand the score of a new Cole Porter musical, has his eyes not on Berle's show, but on the building it's taking place in.
Michael Todd came up with a show called Mexican Hayride, which starred Bobby Clark. He wanted the Winter Garden Theater, but the Follies was in there. Well, he romanced me so much, he gave me two vicuna coats. He gave my former wife, at that time Joyce Matthews, I think, a sable. And we moved the show to the Imperial, which was a smaller cedar. But Michael Todd moved his Mexican hayride in there.
Girl, to the right of me. Girl, to the left of me. Girls in front of me. Girls behind. Girls all over me. I don't mind. Oh, what a rogue am I. Oh, much in vogue am I. Simply smothered in kisses and curls by the girls, 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 girls.
Most of us recall Mike Todd, I think, not as a stage character at all, but as a big-time movie producer. In fact, the surprising thing about him, maybe the most sensational fact of all, is that even though he had a new filming process called Todd.io, named after him, Mike Todd's entire career as a movie producer consisted of only one picture. It's the picture the world remembers, and the picture that I think won Todd a kind of immortality. Next week, Julie Stein and Harold Adamson and Gordon McRae and Johnny Green will tell the story of Mike Todd, whose first and last Hollywood production won 5 Oscars, was supposed to be the prelude to dozens of pictures that never happened, and was a film whose title was perpetuated in one of the dozens of songs that first saw the light of the studio because Mike Todd wanted it there.
Benny Green was talking about next week's American showman, Mike Todd, and that will be, of course, at 7:30.